It's the 11th of November, 2011, and you're listening to The Pod Delusion, a radio programme and podcast about interesting things. I'm James O'Malley. Coming up this week, we answer the questions. Have we finished reforming the libel laws, or would such an assertion be a defamatory and misleading claim? What's it like to live on Mars time, and how many time zones away is it from Hammer time? Why is protest such a tense situation? And if a psychic medium talks to the dead, will the dead talk back? But first, do they know it's Winterfall at all? This week was a big week for surprise U-turns. After all, Silvio Berlusconi finally resigned following his completely inexplicable tenure as Italian Prime Minister. But perhaps the biggest shock was a bit closer to home, as the Daily Mail finally admitted that, if you have children listening, I advise you just cover their ears right now, that Winterfall isn't actually a real thing. Sure, it's a nice bit of childish fun for members of the political correctness brigade to do with their family around winter. You know, I mean, sometimes I leave a health and safety manual out or a pamphlet on diversity on Winterfall's Eve, even though I know that it's not a real thing. But alas, now the penny has finally dropped for the mail, as Dave Cross reports.
Do you celebrate Christmas? Or do the forces of political correctness in your town ban that word so that you have to celebrate Winterfall instead? Readers of most of the British press will know what I'm talking about. For years, oppressive local councils have been rebranding Christmas as Winterfall in order to avoid offending non-Christians. Except, of course, it isn't really like that at all. The truth, as is often the case in these situations, is a lot less scary than the press would have you believe. Let's take a look at the history of Winterfall. Back in 1997, Birmingham Council decided they wanted to have an overarching brand that would cover 40-odd days of winter events that were taking place from the middle of November through to the end of December. These events included things as diverse as Children in Need, Diwali, New Year's Eve, and, of course, Christmas. The council's head of events, Mike Chubb, and his team came up with the name Winterfall. The Winterfall period came and went. It was a success, so the council decided to repeat it the following year. Just before the start of Winterfall 1998, a local paper, the Sunday Mercury, published a story which planted the seeds of the Winterfall myth which have continued to grow until today. The story reported on a letter from the Bishop of Birmingham, where he claimed, against all evidence, that the name Winterfall was chosen as a way of not talking about Christmas. This story was picked up by the national press, there's even a story on the BBC website, and it started to grow and transform in the disappointing way that political correctness gone mad stories tend to do. Over the next decade, the story was dragged out every year as evidence of some mythical war on Christmas, where atheists and other non-Christians were trying to destroy the very fabric of British society. The origins and growth of this story were examined in great detail by blogger Kevin Arscott in an extended essay called The Winterfall Myth, which he published last December. It's worth pointing out that the only person who has banned Christmas in Britain was Oliver Cromwell, who did it because Christmas was a pagan festival. But of course, the war on Christmas gets earlier every year. This year, one of the earliest sightings of the Winterfall myth was in a piece by Daily Mail columnist Melanie Phillips. In a column about the BC-AD controversy that we covered a few weeks ago, she stated that Christmas had been renamed Winterfall in various places. Notice that apart from the lie that Christmas had been renamed, she also expands Birmingham to several places. Kevin Arscott tried to point out the error in this article in an email exchange with Phillips. Initially, she claimed that there was no way that Arscott could know more about this issue than the many church leaders who had complained about Winterfall over the years. When Arscott refused to back down and continued to explain the facts to her, she changed tack. She threatened to sue him for libel before saying that she would no longer reply to his messages. This from a woman who had previously claimed that libel is being used to stifle legitimate debate in the UK. Unfortunately for Phillips, the Mail had recently started to publish a corrections and clarifications column. This was an initiative announced by Mail editor Paul Dacre when he spoke to the Leveson Inquiry earlier this year. Two or three times a week, there's a small column on page 2 which corrects a few errors that the paper has made. Often these corrections are uninteresting. An early example apologised for printing the Union flag the wrong way up, but occasionally they can be more worthwhile. They've also publicised an email address where readers can suggest corrections. That's corrections@dailymail.co.uk if you're interested. A reader of the Tabloid Watch blog decided to use this facility to complain about Phillips' article. Tabloid Watch has published a fascinating article about what happened next. The Mail dragged its feet for some time and made several ridiculous attempts to defend the piece, but eventually they capitulated. On Tuesday of this week, after a negotiation which had lasted 6 weeks, the Mail's corrections column included the following. We stated in an article on 26th of September that Christmas had been renamed in various places Winterval. Winterval was the collective name for a season of public events, both religious and secular, which took place in Birmingham in 1997 and 1998. We are happy to make clear that Winterval did not rename or replace Christmas. That's an amazing admission by the Mail. Although this correction only mentions one specific article, it effectively undermines a story that they have been running periodically for over 10 years. In that time, they've printed over 40 articles about Winterval. So what happens now? Have all Mail writers received a memo pointing out that Winterval did not replace Christmas and asking them not to use this example in the future? We're just getting into the prime time of year for War on Christmas stories. Surely Richard Littlejohn won't be able to resist writing something claiming that political correctness is spoiling our traditional Christmas. But an important piece of ammo in the war has been effectively neutered. Of course, it's not completely over. Other papers might still repeat the myth, but you're going to look pretty stupid publishing a story that even the Daily Mail admits is nonsense. And what of Melanie Phillips, the writer whose piece finally forced the Mail to admit their mistake? She has been silent on the issue since the correction was published. Will she too apologise for misleading her readers? Will she apologise for threatening to sue Kevin Ascot when he pointed out what the Mail have now admitted? Or will she continue to repeat the myth, just not in the Mail? Only time will tell. But all in all, it's been a good week for people who try to correct the nonsense that passes for news in much of our press. Happy Winterval, everyone. This is Dave Cross for the Pod Delusion.
Now, there was an interesting libel case in the High Court yesterday and today, that's the 10th and 11th of November. A friend of the show, David Alan Green, recently reported that the case involved Professor Richard Dawkins, the Richard Dawkins Foundation, Amazon, the online retailer, and Vaughan Jones, a blogger. As far as I can tell, it seems the case involves a religious author suing that lot for the alleged libelous words written about the company and author of a book called The Attempted Murder of God. The author claims that this book is a satire or parody of the evolution-creationism debate and seemingly posed as a creationist to get this point across. What the author's complaint is about, however, is not entirely evident at this stage. However, the case does seem to revolve around creationism and religion and freedom of expression to criticise. Surprisingly, the case has already been dragging on for 2 years. The hearings this week are an attempt to strike out the case brought by Chris McGrath and his company, McGee Productions. If Vaughan wins his application, it seems that the case ends there and then. If Vaughan loses his application, it doesn't mean that he loses the case. It simply means that the court believes it needs all of the facts to be discussed at what could be a very expensive and time-consuming jury trial. It's a bit like what happened for Simon Singh. We'll hopefully have Vaughan on the show next week to find out a bit more. But in the meantime, what does it mean for the cause of libel reform? That's right, despite the high-profile Simon Singh case we've previously featured on the programme at length, the libel laws remain unreformed. Last Wednesday saw a lobby of Parliament by the Libel Reform Campaign in what seems to be the start of the final push to get the reforms into the Queen's Speech, and therefore scheduled to be voted upon in Parliament next year. To find out more about what happened, here's Trish Ann.
Hey, so apparently, libel law in the UK is still, as yet, unreformed. I know, right? It seems like ages ago that we had a big libel gig, first libel lobby in Parliament, and all that publicity for the need for change in order to prevent illiberal and misconceived libel cases ruining the lives of people who are merely publishing their research. But Simon Singh won his case, so why are we still in limbo? Well, Simon didn't win his case. Upon appeal, the BCA withdrew. But after a few £100,000 and a couple of years of torment, I suppose that counts as a victory. There was another vague victory earlier this year, when cardiologist Dr. Peter Wilmshurst had his case against him dropped when the American medical device manufacturer, NMT, went into liquidation rather suddenly. But neither of these cases were actually won. They merely disappeared in a puff of smoke, leaving behind a trail of financial and emotional turmoil, not just for those who were sued, but also for anyone sitting on important information who might be too intimidated to publish it. So on Wednesday evening, I hopped on a train up to London and made my way over to Parliament for the latest libel lobby. I'll admit I didn't speak to my MP beforehand. He signed the EDM back in 2009, and since then he's been rather busy with Russian spies, so I left him alone. Instead, I went straight to the committee room and managed to get a seat, which was lucky because by the time Dr. Evan Harris started the meeting, it was standing room only. The event was hosted by the MP Julian Huppert, and there were comments from a range of interested parties, including Mumsnet, Facebook, AOL, the Citizens Advice Bureau, Nature and Witch magazine, Liberty, the Publishers Association, and of course our heroes, Dr. Peter Wilmshurst and Simon Singh. Those speaking did so with passion and commitment, but it was worrying to hear their stories. Like with Citizens Advice Bureau being hounded by lawyers acting for high street shops over their expose on civil recovery schemes. Or Facebook, Mumsnet and AOL being threatened because their users can post anonymous content. The politicians in attendance voiced their opinions and made it clear that there was no quick resolution on the horizon. Lord McNally, the Minister of State for Justice, said that he wanted to get the defamation bill onto an ex-Queen's speech, but he sounded a bit doubtful, to be honest, and there were loads of sports analogies about getting to the try line and the scrum is moving, but it didn't really work for me. It just sounded a bit patronising. I appreciate this is probably how politics works, but for an outsider like me, it just came across as empty. I've been to Parliament a total of twice, both times for libel reform lobbies, and the first time I went, I was full of naive hope and optimism. Since then, I've been thoroughly disappointed with the political processes in this country and will need a lot of incentive to even vote again. My Lib Dem membership card went up in smoke before it had even expired. So spending £20 on a train fare to London to hear politicians make snide remarks to each other in front of a packed crowd of people who were there to hear good news about the progress of libel reform really put me off. It also reminded me that we can't assume that it's in the hands of the politicians and that they're dealing with it. The libel reform campaign needs you, the Pod Delusion listener, to get involved and to show your support. I sincerely hope that you signed the petition on libelreform.org years ago, but if for some reason you missed it, please do it straight away, it's hugely important. And while you're on the website, have a look around and see if there's anything you can do to help. Write to your MP and make sure they're on side. Speak to your friends and family and get them interested. We need to keep the pressure on to make sure that the defamation bill gets through to the Queen's speech next year. It's in the public interest, and we, my friends, are the public. Stay interested. This is Trish Han, trying not to give up hope for the Pod Delusion.
Now, protest is an integral part of living in a democracy. After all, if you can't stand in the streets and shout your opinions at people, then you may as well be dead. However, despite the protests that kicked off in London again this week, it seems that the man isn't too keen on them, as Stephen Sumter reports.
The right to protest is an important part of our democracy. Since we have a representative democracy rather than a direct democracy, that is, we elect MPs to make decisions for us rather than voting on every issue, it is even more important to have the right to inform our MPs that we disagree with what they are doing and push for change to their policies. We get to vote for a representative every 4 or 5 years, but we must be able to influence their policies in between elections. And sometimes writing a letter or meeting an MP is not enough. The government recognises the right to protest and even says so on the DirectGov website. I quote, "The right to peaceful protest is a vital part of democracy and it has a long, distinguished history in the UK." Although the tradition of protest goes as far back as having someone in charge does, the right to protest is not explicitly stated in law. Instead, it is protected by the rights recognised in the Human Rights Act, specifically a right to peaceful assembly, a right to freedom of expression, a right to freedom of thought, conscience and religion, a right to respect for private and family life. Those in power recognise the right to protest and always claim to facilitate it, but they always include and emphasise the word peaceful in that phrase. Of course, the laws against vandalism, violence and other behaviour remain in place during protest, so in some ways the word peaceful is redundant. The reason that word is included is to provide an excuse for curtailing the protest as soon as it is perceived to be disobedient. In protests in London on Wednesday, the police controlled the march in a number of ways. Prohibited protesters from leaving the route of the march, prohibited protesters from entering certain streets, prohibited protesters from assembling for more than 2 hours at the end of the march, stopped and searched coaches on their way to the protest, delaying some beyond the start, had overwhelming numbers of police who were intimidating to protesters, surrounded the march on all sides, making it impossible to see the protesters, forcibly removed protesters and their tents from Trafalgar Square, stopped and searched people at random, demanded that people remove face coverings, snatched certain people out of the crowd and removed them from the protest, had undercover police in the crowd, held protesters in place for some time at the end of the march with no information on why or how to leave, frequently blocked the protesters' way and held them up, and intimidation of would-be protesters with talk of baton rounds and warning letters sent to protesters before the march. The first three items on this list are courtesy of Section 12 of the Public Order Act 1986. The more I find out about this legislation, the more I realise how draconian and evil it is. It does not seem to add anything worth having to existing laws, instead giving police the ability to control and bully people. Section 12 allows police to tell people where they can and can't go, and how long they can be there. Section 14 actually allows police to order people to stay in one place, to restrict the numbers that can protest, and to tell them to go home. Section 60 allows the police to stop and search whoever they like without reason. Section 60AA allows them to order people to remove any clothing that might conceal their identity. This includes scarves, even if it's freezing cold. And for what purpose? The police would get a person's identity if they arrested them for a crime, so the only reason to reveal the identity can be to gather details of who is protesting. Again, treating protest as a crime. I will give some credit to the police. There was, as far as I know, no prolonged containment and no batons used today. The march seemed, from my perspective via television and Twitter, to be largely peaceful. This may in part be to the sheer numbers of police on the streets. I know that some people would criticise the police if they did not have so many officers out there, but I believe this quantity of police to be overwhelming and intimidating. I have said before, and will say again, that if the police simply left people alone, then that would remove the cause of most of the violence at previous protests. Yes, there might have been some vandalism. However, police should target vandals if and when they do something wrong. Medieval Jewish philosopher Maimonides said, "It is better and more satisfactory to acquit 1,000 guilty persons than to put a single innocent one to death." If this is applied to protests, it is better to let 100 vandals go free than to stamp on the right to protest of 10,000. Police should leave protesters alone and stop trying to control them. This has been Stephen Sumter reporting for The Pod Delusion.
Now, talking to the dead. Unfortunately, we don't have an interview with Jimmy Savile this week, but this week Drury has been wondering about the implications of what would happen if we did. Well, he sort of has anyway. Here's Drew with more.
This is a public service announcement from the Coalition for Control of the Dark Arts.
Citizens! At least a majority of psychics, or so-called psychics or spiritualists, are in fact skilled mentalists. They are entertainers employing a skill for the purpose of impressing their audience. This, we believe, is honest, wholesome fun, and we absolutely approve. We are aware that some skeptics are concerned that punters may mistake the illusion for reality. We in the Coalition are concerned about the opposite problem. Magic, which involves communication with the dead, is called necromancy, and it is black magic. That is to say, it is evil. And if you believe in souls, which presumably you do if you are involved in communicating with the dead, you are jeopardizing your soul by taking part. We fear that there are people who pretend to be mentalists who are in fact cheating using black magic. Imagine if it was revealed that the winner of the Olympic 100-meter sprint in fact attained their speed through a pact with the devil. That would be unfair, unsportsmanlike, un-British. Fake mentalism is even worse. There are people out there displaying signs that their act is for entertainment purposes only, when in fact it is not entertainment, it is true necromancy. Every member of the audience of such an act is putting their eternal soul in peril by partaking in black magic rituals when they thought that they were just observing clever tricks. We repeat, communication with the dead is necromancy. It is a vile form of cheating, risking souls just to cover up a lack of skill as a cold reader or mentalist. The for entertainment purposes only notice is insufficient safeguard. Every person performing a psychic act must make a public statement on oath that they are actually using clever tricks such as cold reading or hidden earphones. We do not insist that they reveal which trick they are using. We accept that that is part of the entertainment mystique, but they must promise that they are not cheating by actually communicating with the dead. The recent Barnum Project encourages theatres not to accept psychic acts that mislead people as to their true nature. We fully support this initiative. Do not be fooled by dangerous magic wielders pretending to be innocent entertainers. Although they would never have the effrontery to admit it, some of these so-called clever tricks may actually be real.
This is a paid political advertisement by the Coalition for Control of the Dark Arts. The Coalition is a registered Bernal Profits organisation.
So whilst psychic mediums talking to the dead seems like a fairly quaint and silly thing to do these days, it turns out that back in the olden days, people thought that the tools of telecommunications could be used to speak to the so-called other side. Sure, they might not seem like natural bedfellows, but when you think about it, the likes of UK Gold are just following a rich tradition of digging up the corpses of the dead and flogging them to make some money. Here's Sarah Anglis with more.
In 1933... Howard Flynn heard a dead woman speak. It happened in the company storeroom, where he found an old wax cylinder lying undisturbed in a sealed wooden box. Flynn fetched a phonograph left by his predecessor, the inventor Thomas Edison. If there were sounds recorded on the cylinder, this machine would play them back. But the cylinder was covered in mildew, which obscured any grooves on it like moss on a gravestone. Undeterred, Flynn slipped the cylinder over the mandrel of the phonograph, wound the handle to make the mandrel spin, and placed the phonograph stylus where he thought the groove might be.
When I am no longer even a memory, just a name, I hope my voice may perpetuate the great work of my life.
The voice, Florence Nightingale, recorded 43 years earlier by Colonel George Edward Gouraud, Edison's agent in London. This was a job that suited the Colonel perfectly, as he was an enthusiastic early adopter of technology, a geek in fact. In the 1890s, the Colonel lived in Little Menlo, an upmarket villa in South Norwood, London. There he had electric lighting, electric carpet sweepers, and electric shoe cleaners, and he rode around on a motorised tricycle. The phonograph, Edison's sound recorder, was entirely mechanical, but nonetheless jaw-dropping to Londoners who heard it for the first time in 1888. On her cylinder, Nightingale remembers her comrades at Balaclava. But it's the opening seconds of the recording which I find so striking, the words that she chooses as she lays down her voice. When I am no longer a memory, just a name, I hope my voice may perpetuate the great work of my life.
Riding majestically toward us like some great feather, riding the sword was mighty proud of a place of playing in the world's aviation. The ship is no doubt bustling with activities we can see. Orders.
Today we live in an era of transmitted sound, where it's commonplace to hear disembodied voices on MP3s and podcasts and radio. But it's worth remembering how very odd it was to experience a disembodied voice for the first time. Here's a quote from Scientific American, December the 22nd, 1877. The reporter has just returned from Edison's workshop, where he's witnessed one of Edison's first demonstrations of the phonograph.
Edison came into this office, placed a little machine on our desk, turned a crank, and the machine inquired as to our health, asked us how we liked the phonograph, informed us that it was very well, and bid us a cordial good night.
This early demonstration recorded the grooves on tinfoil.
We have already pointed out the startling possibility of the voices of the dead being reheard through this device, and there is no doubt but that its capabilities are fully equal to other results just as astonishing. When it becomes possible, as it doubtless will, to magnify the sound, the voices of such singers as Parepa and Titians will not die with them, but will remain as long as the metal in which they may be embodied will last.
It's fascinating to hear the preoccupations of that science journalist, and of Nightingale, both of whom were experiencing recorded sound for the first time. There's no suggestion that either thought they could cheat death with sound recording. Working in military field hospital, Nightingale knew better than anyone that the dead were dead. But the blurring of boundaries between the living and the dead was something the Victorians found compelling. Take a look at the post-mortem photographers, for example, who were using another emerging technology to present the dead in peaceful, lifelike poses surrounded by their living relatives. Yes, there were hoaxers. For example, those who manipulated photographs in the darkroom to fake evidence of ghost. But I also see a dance between fraud and genuine inquiry. Many were playing with the boundaries of life and death or musing on them as they were trying to grasp how recording technologies might transform our identity. I'll be talking about these ideas on Saturday at the 40 and Times Unconvention, where I'll also be recording a voice on wax for optional use beyond the grave. I'll also look at early speech radio, a medium which could be used to seek out voices that travel wirelessly and almost instantaneously over vast distances. It's no surprise that a few scientists, as well as lay users, over-egged what early radio might do. As a rationalist who's happy to talk to anyone about scepticism, I'll admit I'm actually a little jealous of those Victorian and Edwardian experimenters. We're blasé about transmitting voices across oceans, hearing the voices of the dead, and using recorded sound to rehearse moments over and over again.
It's practically standing still now. They've dropped rope out of the nose of the ship, and it's been taken a hold of down on the field by a number of men.
But those early experimenters knew such feats were remarkable. Has my worldview been shaken by a single demonstration of a gadget? My first game of TV tennis? My first CD? Receiving my first email? Well, they were exciting, but they don't quite compete. I hope you've enjoyed this taster of my Uncon talk. Find out more about this and the sound recordings in this article on the Pod Delusion website. I'm Sarah Anglis, engineer and musician. When I'm no longer a memory, even a name, I hope someone out there will enjoy this podcast.
Now, if you're a fan of Microsoft Excel, then you'll love this next report by Liz Luckendorf, who's been finding out just how much faffing about is involved back on Earth when we send stuff into space. Here's Liz with more.
At the London Science Festival, we had a chance to talk to Craig Leff and Kevin Fong about what I like to call Space Kit. Craig Leff is currently the project manager for ExoMars PanCam at University College London, but also, quote, worked on Mars Time with the first rover project. At the festival, he gave a talk on that theme, the logistics of working on Mars Time. To give an example, the Mars orbit is 40 minutes longer than the Earth, so it rapidly gets out of sync with Earth time. Most of this interview is about very techie details indeed. James asked the first techie question, how much bandwidth is there to transmit data from Mars back to Earth?
Good day, I think, is about 200 megabits, and that's just going by memory, and someone will listen and call and say, oh, you idiot, here's the right answer, but 200 megabits was the flavor of it.
So how much was that in terms of, could you intake, like, X number of pictures, or did
depends.
You have to balance that
with? It depends on how many pictures, how big they are, how many spectral channels you're taking. Mm. Obviously, on every mission, images are the big data hog. Mm. They're coolest, and everyone wants to see them. You can't fly a mission without it, but they take up the most bandwidth. Things like Mossbauer, which measures, and APXS, both chemistry instruments, Mossbauer looks at iron in particular, are a bunch of squiggly lines and a few bits of data. And that's not making fun of those guys at all. They do great stuff, really interesting instruments, but they just don't take up the kind of bandwidth that imaging does. And I didn't mean to single them out. They came to mind first, and I'm going to get calls from the chemistry community now. I shouldn't, but... So the answer is it all depends. You also have to remember that you have flash on board, so that if you take a 360-degree color panorama of where you are, you might, it'll take several sols to even collect that, but it'll take way more sols than that to send it down. Because even, let's say you're really, really lucky and really do get 200 megabits per day for Z days in a row, it's going to take a long time to get all that data down. And one of the things you don't want to do is on days where you drive and don't take much data, have nothing to send down, have a big fat pipe and no data. So you always keep something on board so you're not sucking on a dry straw, as they used to say. So, I mean, you can go down to multiple. Data management becomes its whole own thing. Didn't mention, or actually took out the slides about critical downlink and critical uplink, what things need to get up, what things need to come down tomorrow. If you're going to drive tomorrow, you absolutely positively have to have the images in the drive direction.
How much can the rover actually do on its own? Can it intelligently respond to conditions it
comes? Yeah, absolutely. There, as Scott Maxwell, the Mars rover driver, wrote, said, some of these answers are ridiculously complicated, but there are multiple modes of driving the rover. One, you just say, see that pointy rock over there? Go to it, and you just send it on its way. It can do it completely on its own. It's really slow because it has to creep along, make sure it hasn't done anything, creep along anymore, make sure it's still okay, creep along, make sure it's all okay. There are various levels of autonomy, various levels of how much you want to leave it on its own. On the other hand, there's something called a blind drive, where it's a ASDA car park. It's 50 acres of tarmac, and you know it's not going to hit anything. And you say, drive over there as fast as you can. Trust me, you're not going to hit anything. And it just goes. Now, when we're talking flat out, we're talking 6 centimeters a second, which I think I calculated as 1-point-something miles an hour. So even, it's not going to... There will be no rooster tails like there were on the man-driven lunar rovers on the moon.
Are there orders of magnitude of complexity that go up with each successive rover and how fast they can drive and data and, like, what they can do?
There are... I mean, Pathfinder was a technology experiment. It was small. It wasn't meant to do much. It actually had no imaging. If you remember, Pathfinder was actually different. It landed on... It had a lander, which had all the smarts, had a camera, had all the communications on that. And the rover drove down a little ramp and was sort of like letting the dog out the back door, let the dog out the doggy door, if you will. And it went and did some stuff. But it was a fairly basic, simple rover. The big point of it was, can you drop something in airbags on another surface and have it work? And it did, and it worked spectacularly well. MIR was bigger. Airbags were more complicated. The instrumentation was more complicated. It had its own camera. There was no lander. There was no mothership, no mother base. It had no smarts in it. You drove off and never saw it again. That's why I put a couple of those pictures in there. I'd love those where you see wheels going away from it and you'll never see it again. There's one where you can look back tens of meters across and can still kind of see the, triangular shape of the thing sitting across. And that's it. It's done. Never to be used again. It's sort of sad and lonely sitting there. There's software complexity. People get smarter at doing autonomy. It's also hardware. You just can't go down to your local computer shop and buy the fastest Intel chip, because can't put up with the hot, can't put up with the cold, can't put up with the radiation in particular. So you have to buy rad hard chips. And the MIR chip, I forget, is slow. It's 386 sticks in my mind. I don't, again, the chemistry people will come with the with the pitchforks, and the computer science people come after you with the torches. But it's a very slow chip by compared to what's in your what's in the phone you're using to record this. But it's the fastest space ready chip that was available at the time. Now I don't know what the fastest space ready chip is now. But it's going to be faster than that. So by definition, any rover built by the UK or Europe or the US is going to be smarter, faster, just because software is better, as we discussed earlier, and it's that the hardware it can run on is going to be better. It's still not to what you'd expect off the shelf, but time marches on.
Kevin Fong is the co-director of the Center for Aviation, Space and Extreme Environment Medicine at University College London. He is also well known for his broadcasting work, especially that of Horizon. His talk at the London Science Festival focused on the shuttle missions, and especially the very last shuttle launch. In this brief section of the interview, we talk again about the shuttle program and the future of spaceflight. We first asked, how much difference is there from launching the Saturn rockets to how the shuttle was launched?
It wasn't really an evolution from Saturn, the Saturn V architectures, because, you know, those had evolved from the Mercury and Gemini missions, and then Apollo came, and that evolved, it was a pretty straightforward evolution. They got bigger and more capable. But shuttle was really a sort of a step change and brought a huge amount of innovation. It will, for a long time, be the most complicated vehicle that you'll ever see fly in space. And that's part of the problem, because it was so complicated that it needed a huge workforce to service it when it was back on the ground. And shuttle was expensive, not because it's made of platinum leaf or something, it's because it took a huge workforce that all had to be salaried to service it and return it to flight each time. But that doesn't get away from the fact that it was, as a feat of engineering, pretty miraculous. You know, you forget that it was first designed in the 1970s. And in the 1970s, it was like nothing the world had ever seen before. And still, at the start of the 21st century, it will remain something the likes of which we may never see again, certainly not as capable and multifaceted a vehicle.
Do you think we'll ever reach a point where we'll have space travel which is more akin to being as relatively easy as taking a flight is?
Well, it's difficult to know, isn't it? I mean, you can never say never, and you would hope that future evolutions will give us much more genuinely reusable human-rated space vehicles, but it's really about energy. You know, when you look at the enormous energies that are involved in getting anything into low Earth orbit, forget about going then beyond after that. It is difficult to make it routine. You know, you are talking about a feat that is going from naught to 25 times the speed of sound in a few minutes. You know, the sort of energies that are comparable to a small nuclear warhead. And taking that, harnessing that and making it routine is going to take quite an effort.
The most fascinating thing I thought was the variable-type rocket or engine that someone is building, and that could get people to Mars in a month. When I was a kid, it was like 10 years, 10, 15 years. It was like ridiculous timescales to get to Mars. How is that dramatically contracted now?
If you look at what it takes to get to Mars and you look at a conventional chemical propulsion rocket or even the nuclear thermal propulsion units, you're still talking about, you know, many, many months to get there, between 6 and 9 months probably, something like that. Depending on the launch window and the specific opportunity. And that's simply because, you know, there are fundamental limits on how large and how powerful a chemical rocket you can build and still get a sensible payload on top of it and still make the whole thing affordable. And so the Vasimir rocket, which is a, you know, variable specific impulse magnetoplasma rocket, has huge advantages in that it can achieve massive thrust and simultaneously massive efficiencies just by altering the way that the magnetic nozzle throttles the magnetoplasma at the back. So Vasimir is potentially a very powerful and at the same time very efficient rocket. So that's really where those advantages come from. But it's a question of energy again. You still need an energy source to drive it. And instead of an energy, a chemical energy source this time, you're talking about nuclear power and probably nuclear fusion. So you do need that paired technology advance. But I do think that's where the future of human spaceflight is, that it requires enabling technology before you can go to some of these more exotic destinations. You know, once you know where you want to go and how you might get there, then you'll hope that in some other field of science and engineering, some enabling technology will come along and redraw the boundaries again.
Do you think it's more important that we should be exploring further into the solar system, trying to get to Mars, or getting wider access to the bits of space we've already conquered?
Well, you want to be doing both. I mean, you know, you've got to continue to push back the frontiers. That's what exploration is about. The commercial model is the commercial model, and you've got to hope that that's going to become sustainable because that enables the science and the exploration that you want to do. But, you know, we can't just languish around in low Earth orbit just because that's the only thing that makes a fast buck. That's not what exploration has ever been about, and that's not what science is about. And so if you are interested in getting science from human exploration of space, then you've got to go further and you've got to go to new places.
There are longer versions of both these interviews on the Poddelusion website if you are interested in more techie details. This has been Liz Lussendorf geeking out about space toys for the Poddelusion.
Also this week, Kylie Sturgis has been investigating the front lines of a war which we don't always hear about. The war on Wikipedia. Behind the scenes, every single edit is scrutinised, presumably mostly to see what side of the "is Paul McGann canon or not" debate the edit falls upon, but it also turns out it's checked for factual accuracy. And as Kylie has discovered, Wikipedia can be a great place for subtly advocating a sceptical point of view.
I'm Kylie Sturgis. And like me, I'm willing to bet that you're one of the estimated 365 million readers of a website called Wikipedia. But what if you're a sceptically minded, pro-rationalist, pro-secularist kind of person, and you want Wikipedia to be as accurate on those topics as it is on Doctor Who episodes? I spoke with Susan Gerbic, creator of the website Guerrilla Skepticism on Wikipedia, on how she went from being a reader like you and me to becoming an online activist to improve Wikipedia.
Well, I'm a skeptical junkie, and I was very social for many years, reading magazines, attending the lectures and conferences. I was kind of hoping for some way to kind of help out the skeptical groups, but I didn't really have any skills or any way to contribute. I really don't have any computer skills other than, you know, using the internet. So I met Mark Edward on a JREF cruise in 2009. We became friends and we had a lot in common. Well, Mark started getting involved in the independent investigation group in Los Angeles in California. And I'd visit him and I started going to the IIG meetings in LA, which is an investigation group that we actually do things. We have a $50,000 challenge. Right now, we're the biggest skeptical investigation group out there. I knew I'd found a place where I could be useful, so even though it's a long ways away. So I've got my hand in a lot of pies with the IIG, and it's a growing group, and it really does stuff with a lot of volunteers. So that's kind of what my background is.
So what led Susan to choose Wikipedia?
I was on a different cruise, this time in the Caribbean, and Tim Farley, who has whatstheharm.net, I heard him talk about editing Wikipedia for skeptical content. You know, I thought that's a great idea, but I didn't really think about it for a while. So I take a lot of pictures, and I thought, you know, maybe I could add some of these pictures to Wikipedia pages. And so that kind of led me to editing articles and then to the guerrilla skepticism idea, which was Mark Edwards' idea to become more aggressive in the skeptical movement. And then TAM9 came rolling around. I've been to many TAMs, the amazing meeting, the JRIS amazing meeting. And this time I petitioned to be do a paper on the Sunday. And they accepted me. And before I could do that, I had to do a lot of, you know, I had to turn in a paper. I had to write a blog-like article. I had to do a lot of things. So that made me kind of focus on writing a blog. Now my blog has kind of taken off where I'm really doing a lot of editing and a lot of blogging, trying to get other people to help edit. And I'm trying to get an editing army together.
But it's one thing to write online. It's another thing to make it popular.
Well, I see the numbers of people hitting my site, but I don't I don't see a lot of comments, and I, you know, I get kind of discouraged at times, and I tell myself, well, I'm just writing for myself, because I get constant comments about, oh, this is a great idea. Thank you so much. Wonderful, wonderful. I want people to say, where can I start? What can I do? How about this? How about that? That's where I'm looking for. I want actual conversations with people. Some of the big name pages like homeopathy, astrology, those are constantly people are coming in and trying to mess with them. I advocate that people start with pages that are less known, mm-hmm. and they can learn from there too. But I have advice about this on my blog, how to go about getting an edit to stay, how to remain neutral, how to, you know, but there is arbitration and things. They have ways of dealing with people who were upset and how to reach a consensus. There is a billion things, well, maybe not a billion, I'm exaggerating a little bit, but there are a lot of things that people can do if they don't want to edit. One of the things that can be done is when you have articles, this is kind of my new pet peeve, is everybody's in the skeptical movement is pasting articles up on Facebook for their friends to see.
Yes.
But yet those articles should be going on to Wikipedia, which so the world can see, instead of your little friends, you know, reading them or not. That is what we need to have on Wikipedia. So sometimes it's best if they send the articles to me or, you know, to my blog or to somebody they know who does edit. There's also just trolling around Wikipedia, looking for pages badly in need of edits and just bring it to attention to somebody. Look for pictures that are in the public domain that can be added to pages or take pictures at a local event and we can have those uploaded. Grammar, you know, help reword us. Articles, they can copy it, clean it up, and just bring it to mine or somebody else's attention, and we can paste it in there. And really, something new that a lot of people can get involved in is I have a project. It's concentrating on the English Wikipedia, because that's, I mean, I concentrate only on English Wikipedia, but there's a lot of other languages that are Wikipedia languages, and they experience the same problems we do with critical content in all the different countries, but they lack the support we have in the English-speaking world. You know, we have lots of meetups. We have lots of organizations. And so what I've done is I've written two paragraphs that explain what I'm trying to do with adding skeptical content to articles. And those two paragraphs probably sum up the project, the Guerrilla Skepticism on Wikipedia, the best. I'm trying to get those two paragraphs translated into as many languages as possible.
Wow. And wow.
I need places to leave those paragraphs once they're translated. And what will happen, let's say we translate them into Spanish. Well, we need places to go to actually paste them in. And then the people reading the skeptical blog in Spanish or somebody's talking about it on a podcast or whatever, they'll be able to get editors who will be doing exactly what I'm advocating, but in Spanish. And so I'm trying to do this because it's too important of a project to keep it in English. The rest of the world deserves to have a source of knowledge that's free of the paranormal garbage, too.
I then asked Susan, what do you think are the factors that lead people to not contribute to Wikipedia?
I think it's several things.
Yeah.
The Wikipedia culture is kind of difficult to get comfortable in. They use a lot of odd terms that mean nothing to a new editor, and that can be kind of off-putting. Also, when you try to make edits and someone comes in and reverts it, that's really frustrating. You know, and Kelly, there's one more thing, too. I think there's no real applause when you're working on this project. There's nobody high-fiving you, nobody commenting about how you just made a difference to the movement.
Yeah.
And, I started the blog, which helped me find other editors to talk to, so I can share my edits with other people, but I think that might be part of the reason why a lot of people don't edit Wikipedia. They get frustrated with it, and I think that there's no feedback.
You can understand where Susan's Guerrilla Skepticism on Wikipedia site would enable people to build up a community spirit and network together as an army of skeptics and rationalists online. So why does Susan enjoy contributing to Wikipedia?
The power of it, honestly.
Power! Yes.
Powerful. I know that the edits I'm making are being read by the world. And this project is just so important because if you write a blog about, oh gosh, homeopathy, and you think, okay, I've got this great angle on homeopathy, I'm going to write this blog on it, and you're not P.Z. Myers or Phil Plait or, you know, somebody who's got a blog that's got a huge following, you're going to get what? A couple hundred hits. But if you take and you find some really great sources on homeopathy or power balance bracelets or something like that, and you put it up on Wikipedia, oh my goodness, you're going to have thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of people are reading your work. You know, I just kind of talk it up a lot. I'm trying to get a lot of interest in it. I put it on Facebook and Twitter, some of my edits, and just trying to get people to, you know, get excited about it and feel like they're part of a community.
Thank you very much to Susan Gerbic for telling us all about Guerrilla Skepticism on Wikipedia, and to Milton Mermakidis for his song Membrane. Head to the Pod Delusion site to get links and learn more. I'm Carly Sturgis for the Pod Delusion.
Finally this week, Peter Rowlett has been finding out about some of the grand plans one man has for furthering the cause of mathematics. Samuel Hansen has somehow got funding to put together a series of podcasts about prime numbers. That's right, someone has worked out how to make podcasting their job. I'm a bit jealous. I wonder what factors contributed to prime numbers being so easily monetized. That's a math quip right there. Here's Peter Rowlett with more.
Samuel Hansen is a mathematical podcaster from acmescience.com who is visiting the UK for his crowd-funded podcasting project, Relatively Prime. I sat down with him and asked him about the project. So, Sam, what is Relatively Prime?
Relatively Prime's going to be a series of 8-hour-long audio documentaries about mathematics, specifically telling kind of the stories behind what I feel, at least, is interesting mathematics. And it's mostly going to be interviews with people. So I'm going to try to get other people to tell the stories that I find interesting. I'm working more as a curator here than a storyteller myself.
So I mentioned this is crowdfunded. What does that mean?
So I used a website called Kickstarter, which I believe is the number one crowdsource funding website there is out there. And what you do is you come up with some sort of project, in Kickstarter's case, a creative project. Most of the other ones like Indiegogo are also creative projects. And you post up your project as well as a list of things that the funders will get if, you know, at certain money levels. It's very much like public radio in the United States. You know, you give $75, you get a tote bag. In my case, you gave $75 and I think you get to read a credit or something like that because honestly, I don't have enough money to buy everyone tote bags. And then you just try to publicize it as best you can. You try to get, you know, kind of like viral buzz going on Twitter or Google Plus or Facebook. Or in my case, you wait until the very, very last day until everyone you know is talking about it and you somehow manage to raise 40% of your entire necessary amount on the last day. And with Kickstarter, and this is not true for all of them, but with Kickstarter specifically, if you don't actually get to your funding level, you don't get anything, which I think is kind of important. So if you think a project is really interesting, you really want to support it and make sure that it goes on, you're kind of invested into making sure that it gets through and telling all of your friends, because otherwise you'll just give money and just forget about it because you know your money's gone. Here, the money's only gone if the project goes forward. And I am proud to say every Kickstarter project I've ever funded has taken my money from me.
Right. So what do you have to do to get it on Kickstarter? I mean, is it just anybody can put up anything?
No, it is not. Because my first time I proposed something, it didn't go through. I had to modify it. They're essentially just making sure that you actually know what's going on. The first time I submitted Relatively Prime, I didn't have everything worked out. I just, you know, kind of wrote like a paragraph like, oh, these are the kind of gifts that I will give out. I think that specifically is what kind of held me back. And then so I spent a few days refining that, actually making all the levels, writing out all of the gifts as well as cleaning up the paragraph explaining the project itself. And then the second time through, they did accept me onto Kickstarter and my project officially kicked off.
Okay, so you mentioned it already, but on the Relatively Prime page, it says, all Samuel ever really wanted to do was tell stories, especially if they happened to be mathematical. So are there many stories to tell in mathematics?
Really? That's the most leading question I've ever heard. Yes, there are.
Good answer.
So here, I guess, is where you're trying to lead me into talking about some of those stories.
Oh, yes.
I have my outline for all the programs I want to do in front of me. And on the side, there's the names of – or the titles of all the programs, such as one. I'm in the UK here to interview people for this project. So while I'm here, I'm actually going to be interviewing Fields Medalist Professor Tim Gowers in Cambridge in order to talk to him about polymath. Now, polymath might be the most narratively structured mathematical story ever. Because this was a project that he started to try to see if mathematicians could get together in the comment section of his blog in order to solve a research problem. And since I'm doing a story on it, you guessed it, they succeeded. And so there's a nice built-in narrative structure there. And so that's definitely why I want to tell that story. But there's other things. How about the fact that if you embed a hyperbolic shape on the graph of the internet, it's more efficient? Like, there's no reason – like, I mean, there's no intuitive reason that something like that would be true. But there's research that has been done to show that that very much is true. How about the most beautiful building I've ever seen, which is in Barcelona, La Sagrada Familia, which is just completely embedded with all kinds of wonderful geometry. And there definitely are stories to tell, like, such as why did Antoni Gaudi decide to use hyperbolic geometry instead of – ones that are more typically used in construction. And so there's a lot of stories that I want to tell. Beating of the game checkers. For mathematicians now, checkers is not a game that's of any interest to play because there is actually an algorithm that can play the perfect game. It cannot lose. And if there's an algorithm that can't lose, just go play chess or go.
Yes. Well, so where else are you going in the UK while you're...
Well, I mentioned at Cambridge to talk to Professor Gowers. I'll also be talking to Professor David Spiegelhalter while I'm in Cambridge. I've already spoken to a couple of people out in London, Matt Parker and Alex Bellos. And then I'm also going to a couple conferences while I'm here. The wonderful Maths Jam conference, which is the greatest mathematical conference ever. I've been to a few, and that is definitely what I believe. And also the... Institute for Mathematics and its Applications Early Career Mathematicians Conference.
So you're going to London, Cambridge, Crewe, Bath. So, I mean, the question is really, what have you got against the north of England?
Well, mostly they're football teams. I do not like them. I'm an Arsenal fan. So I tend to just avoid the north of England.
So where else in the world are you going?
Well, I am going to Barcelona to get some bed audio and to revisit La Sagrada Familia. And then I'm going up and down both coasts of the United States. And I'm going to take a couple of trips into Canada, too. So this is going to be a proper international audio project when it's done.
Okay, so if people are interested to hear you tell these stories, then where can they find out more?
If you just... keep your eye on acmescience.com. There'll definitely be posts there. And then eventually Relatively Prime will be housed at relativelyprime.acmescience.com.
This is Peter Ollett interviewing Samuel Hansen for The Pod Delusion.
And that's it for this week's show. Do check out our website at poddelusion.co.uk, where you can listen back to older episodes of the show, follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook, or find out how to get involved in the show yourself. Also on our website, you can subscribe to donate £5 or £10 a month to the Pod Delusion cause. So if you enjoy what we do, why not subscribe or make a one-off donation with cash? You can find links to do so at poddelusion.co.uk. Pod Delusion this week was brought to you by Dave Cross, Trish Han, Stephen Sumter, Drew Ray, Sarah Anglis, Peter Rowlett, Carly Sturgis, Liz Luckendorf, and me, James O'Malley, with much additional editing by Liz Luckendorf. The Pod Delusion is a partner of the British Humanist Association. The sketch in a moment is by David Lovesey and Brian Too. Thanks for listening.
afternoon, and thank you for coming here today. The U.S. government has called this press conference to categorically state for the record that we have no knowledge of, or indeed evidence, prior contact with extraterrestrial species.
So why are you making this statement today?
We made a pledge to respond to a petition of over 5,000 signatures on the We the People website. 17,000 signatures were collected across two petitions, asking us to disclose whether we have knowledge of alien life.
So the U.S. government has never seen or met anyone you would consider to be an extraterrestrial?
We have no evidence that any life exists outside our planet.
Really? So if I asked you if you had seen Zano Edict 27, the mind-controlling Zabulon from asteroid Almeria 5879, you'd say you'd never met him?
That's right, ma'am. I've never heard of this cool and handsome-sounding person you refer to.
Is that so? He's not hiding under the podium there?
I should say not. This isn't Police Academy. Just who are you, ma'am?
I'm Zomwob Edict 21, Zarno's mother. And if he doesn't stop controlling you and come out from under that curtain, he's going to be astro-grounded for the next 14 lunar cycles.
I don't know what you're talking about, Mom. I mean, Zomwob.
If your father knows you borrowed the spacecraft for one of your jollies...
It's not my fault, Mother. It was a dare. All us young Zabulons are coming down here, controlling people's minds. Brainwashing the masses is the next big thing.
Don't remind me. I promised to pick up your granddad, Ben Edict 16, from the Vatican on the way home.